Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston. And what? Did you really believe Republicans in the United States House of Representatives would hold their dear leader accountable when it came to Jeffrey Epstein and the supposed files? I mean, no one, and I mean no one, should either be shocked, nor surprised, nor stunned that every Republican on the Rules Committee blocked a release of the Epstein investigation files. No one should be. California Democrat Ro Khanna brought the motion to a vote. Good job there, Representative Khanna. And that motion failed to pass because seven Republicans voted against it. Seven Republicans voted against the measure, with one Republican joining the four Democrats to pass it. And also, we just got some breaking news as I'm recording right now. This is from the New Republic, and it just came out at 2:24 on July 15th. It says that House Republicans on Tuesday blocked a rule to release the Epstein files with zero Republicans supporting the measure. The final vote was 211 to 210. One Republican with a spine would have tipped the scale and given the American people greater transparency in the Epstein saga. So there you go. Oh, and nine Republicans chose not to vote because, yeah, they're weak and completely pathetic. So that means every Michigan Republican in the House of Representatives voted to block a release of the Epstein files. But hey, here's a big-time salute to all of you strong-armed Michigan Republicans in Congress like Tom Barrett, John Molinar, Bill Huizenga, Lisa McClain, Jack Bergman, and John James, yes, who's running for governor. Good job on all of you to protect your dear leader at all cost. Wow. These sick MAGA Republicans, bought and paid for by corporate authoritarians, they are more than happy to help cover up everything we know regarding Jeffrey Epstein, who died in prison, supposedly from suicide, although the video shut down when it happened. Just dumb luck. I mean, they're covering up because dear leader wants it covered up. And many inside the regime who claimed to have all the evidence at one time suddenly are joining in the cover-up. They're covering up for their dear leader, who was, as he says, great friends with a known pedophile and child sex trafficker. They're covering up for pedophilia. What kinds of sick human beings are these MAGA Republicans? And equally as sick is how these MAGA influencers like Charlie Kirk, who was determined to reveal the extreme cover-up and scandal behind the Epstein investigation. Like Charlie Kirk has now just quickly remembered that he was always supposed to act as dear leader's water boy. And now Charlie says, it's time to move on from Epstein. So boring. Let's move on. How weak and pathetic and just small these people really are. They used Epstein as a nice talking point and so-called moral marker to convince some of the cult that so many evil people were part of this Epstein ring, a ring that included their very own dear leader. And it always confounded me, always did, as to why so many in MAGA land made it their mission to release everything when it came to Epstein, while their own dear leader, Trump, always had close ties to Epstein himself. I know. He's never been found to do any wrongdoing, and there have never been any charges or anything like that. But we know that he has traveled with Epstein in the past. Hell, it's on record that dear leader declared Jeffrey Epstein to be a good friend for some 15 years. It's also on record that Jeffrey Epstein considered Trump a close friend. Why did MAGA believe that some damning evidence against Epstein and those who traveled along with him would ever get released, since Trump was one of those who paddled around with him for years? We even have that video of when I think it's the Buffalo Bills cheerleaders were at Mar-a-Lago back in the early 90s, and we see Jeffrey Epstein and dear leader Trump there just laughing it up, being good buddies, being good pals. So those of you in MAGA land, did you really believe this was ever going to come out? I mean, remember, Trump even said on record that Epstein liked his women on the young side. And that's the part that is abhorrent, horrifying, and just downright sick. Many of these powerful and elite and untouchable men knew of Epstein's child sex prostitution ring, and they went along with it, or they aided and abetted, or worse, they remained silent. Dear Leader was one of those guys. And again, if it comes out that Bill Clinton was one of them, and we also know that he palled around with Jeffrey Epstein, then so be it. That's the difference between being in a cult and being a free thinker. I don't care. Get them all. And for the life of me, I will never understand why Kamala Harris didn't use Trump's pedophile friend against Trump and hammer him over and over and over with it. I don't know if it would have moved anyone. Maybe not. But you know MAGA would never have hesitated if they would have had something on Harris's husband being on those Epstein flight logs. And they would have used it to their advantage. Sadly, maybe it's because some of the elite Democratic Party officials worried about some of their own friends being involved in the Epstein ring. So they were like, let's don't release any of that stuff. And we wonder why Democratic base voters are no longer trusting those they threw their trust towards for years. We wonder why. I mean, it's why Mamdani wins in New York City while voters dropped Andrew Cuomo and Eric Adams. Oh, I know. Both Cuomo and Adams are still running hapless and hopeless campaigns for the elite class. But it's right here. We are seeing the illustration right here of why people no longer are trusting longtime Democratic established leaders. They feel like those leaders have let them down and that they never fought for them. It's why AOC is winning more and more Democratic voters, voters who just a few years ago vowed never to back AOC because she backed Bernie Sanders. It's why Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed is pulling in nearly $2 million in campaign donations for the Michigan U.S. Senate seat. And it's also why State Senator Mallory McMorrow racked up just over $2 million for the same Senate campaign. People are looking for something new and for someone who will fight not just against the MAGA Republican movement, of course, but someone who will fight and demonstrate that they will fight for the working class. I haven't made any endorsement in that U.S. Senate race, by the way, but I will continue to repeat this assertion. Democratic Congresswoman Haley Stevens enjoys wider name recognition right now. But I am just wondering, what is her angle going to be to sway Democratic voters and independent voters who are outraged, afraid, and who feel unheard while the Trump regime rolls over them and everything that they fought to preserve for their families? When Haley Stevens declared that Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is a good leader, or that ICE ought to be celebrated, she showed us that if Democrats like her get into power, don't expect much to change. What is Haley Stevens' angle on becoming the Democratic nominee for the United States Senate? What is it? I would like to know. Because let's not forget that her pal and stalwart for the working class, Chuck Schumer, voted against Democrats in the Senate, against his very own party, and with Dear Leader Trump and Republicans to pass that awful congressional resolution bill last spring. You remember that, right? I mean, you remember the outrage. Schumer went against many Democrats in the Senate who refused to go along with that resolution, saying that a government shutdown was worse than passing an awful bill against the working class. Chuck Schumer bet on himself. Chuck Schumer bet on the corporate class. Chuck Schumer bet on MAGA Republicans while opposing his colleagues in the Senate. He went along with Dear Leader Trump and MAGA Republicans for what? Schumer said that Democrats were going to try to get some amendments passed in that final resolution back in March. And do you remember how many of those amendments passed? Don't ask. That resolution gave carte blanche to Dear Leader and Elon Musk to gut government agencies and services. And it also then boosted more money for military spending, which for some reason never gets cut back, after, even though we've had numerous inspectors general reports show widespread fraud and abuse. But nothing ever gets cut out of the Pentagon budget. Nothing. I mean, this is why people across Michigan and the country started taking to the streets, because Schumer and other so-called Democratic leaders were just dithering, and they appeared stuck in quicksand. While the country was beginning to fall apart pretty quickly, pretty immediately right after the inauguration. And now the MAGA Supreme Court continues to grant the Trump regime all the power it wants to dismantle government agencies, like it did this week when it ruled that the regime may commence with its plans to destroy the Department of Education. That means the regime and Education Secretary and billionaire oligarch Linda McMahon may continue gutting public education, which is exactly what Project 2025 said it would do. By the way, corporate media, are you ever going to follow up on Project 2025 and how Trump is basically doing exactly what was written in the book? I mean, he told us he wasn't going to pass anything. He didn't even know what the book was about and that it was a crazy book. I mean, a little follow-up would be pretty good. Maybe concentrate on that rather than continuing to tell us that Joe Biden's old. We know that. Anyway, last week, the regime froze nearly $7 billion for K-12 spending, including spending for migrant children, for STEM education, because do we really want kids excelling in math and science, you silly people? And it also froze spending for adult education and literacy programs. Who needs that garbage? We've got billionaires who need tax cuts. So Schumer crapped the bed back in March, because had he stopped that CR bill from passing and played hardball and fought for the working class, who knows if the MAGA murder budget is passed as it passed 2 weeks ago? Who knows if it ever really gets passed? We don't know, because Chuck Schumer chose to lie down. He submitted. He gave up. Because everything Schumer claimed that he was trying to avoid last spring all became law in the MAGA murder budget. Medicaid is getting wiped out. Wiped out. Now, it's not getting wiped out immediately. Cynically, Republicans ensured that those cuts to Medicaid will not occur until after next year's midterm elections. I mean, come on, guys. All of you said this is a popular bill. You said this is what the American people wanted. Should have just ensured that everything starts immediately. But you knew better. MLive this week reported how at least 7 Michigan counties have at least a third of their residents relying on Medicaid. Those 7 counties are Clare, Genesee, Lake, Oscoda, Ogemaw, Saginaw, and Wayne counties. Some of them blue counties, some of them red counties, but guess what? All Michigan counties. All Michiganders. And MAGA Republicans in Michigan, all of them in Congress, voted to hurt hundreds of thousands of their own people so that they could give their rich oligarch friends more money. And, well, let's be honest, many of them are becoming richer in Congress themselves, so they're helping their own pocketbooks, too. I mean, hey, must be nice. Michigan Public Radio, meanwhile, released a story this week detailing how the MAGA murder budget will lead to hundreds of rural hospital closures. Hundreds. A report from University of North Carolina researchers shows how 300 hospitals, 300, are now at risk of shutting down across the nation, including 3 in Michigan, thanks to the MAGA murder budget. That report says the 3 hospitals that'll probably close down, since they rely on federal reimbursements from Medicaid, for example, are McLaren Central in Mount Pleasant. Thank you, Congressman John Molnar. University of Michigan Health Sparrow Carson City Hospital. Hey, thanks again, Congressman John Molnar. And Ascension Borges Lee Hospital in Dowagiac. Hey, thank you, Congressman Tim Walberg. You know what? Speaking of Tim Walberg, and WTVB in Coldwater reported how Tim Walberg now says that, yes, some rural hospitals will close. Listen to this little soundbite.
Well, there will be concerns and ought to be, but that comes as a result of some bad decisions that have been made for years by the systems, by the hospitals themselves. And now, when we have the type of waste, fraud, and abuse, 1.7 billion individuals who shouldn't have been on it, who are taking benefits from hospitals, that's going to cause a problem. We'll have to weather through that.
Yeah. We'll just have to weather through that. We will have to weather through that. Will you, Tim? Will you have to really weather through that? Really, Tim? When a rural hospital closes down, how will you, a congressman, who receives only the best of government health care, how will you weather through it? Something tells me, Tim Walberg, that you won't lose any sleep over it. But thanks for validating and finally admitting how the MAGA murder budget that you, Tom Barrett, John Molinar, Bill Huizenga, Lisa McClain, Jack Bergman, and John James, who's running for governor next year, passed into law and then danced around in a room while celebrating the fact that you're closing down rural hospitals that hardworking Michiganders rely on for themselves and for their families. You danced around for that. Truly, truly sick. And Chuck Schumer, hey, everything you said that you were fighting to keep going by signing that CR bill last spring is all gone because you were weak and you did not understand what the hell was happening. So Haley Stevens, again, since you're running to become the next United States Senator for the state of Michigan, what exactly is your angle in this campaign again? I'd like to hear it. Because another damaging part of the MAGA murder budget is how the Trump regime is eliminating billions of dollars in federal funds designed for clean energy transition and generation. Trump and MAGA Republicans are gutting many planned projects and funding for those projects, projects that won't just help our environment from climate change, as we see its devastating effects like the ice storm in northern Michigan or the tragic Texas flood, but it'll help lead to cheaper and more efficient energy and create thousands and thousands of jobs, some of them good-paying union jobs right here in Michigan. I mean, Michigan's already created thousands of clean energy jobs, but the Trump regime, along with Michigan MAGA Republicans in Congress, celebrated passing a bill that cuts working-class jobs in Michigan while handing China a huge victory for free. Frank Houston is Blue Green Alliance, Michigan's senior state policy manager, and he's standing by to tell us more on how the budget bill is disastrous for Michigan's economy and Michigan's environment. That's all coming up right after this break. You're listening to LOL.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast. If you truly want to get Pat fired up, talk about Tigers baseball or how you think the 90s produced the worst music of any decade. You've been warned. Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com and follow him on Twitter at leftoflansing. Here's Pat.
leftoflansing@gmail.com. leftoflansing@gmail.com is the best way to reach me. When MAGA Republicans in Congress and Trump passed their budget bill, many already knew of the massive cutbacks to Medicaid and SNAP benefits that will devastate millions of working families across the country and hundreds of thousands of Michiganders as well. But we also knew how Republicans were both cynical and slick and how they delayed most of those massive cuts until after next year's midterm elections, as if people would forget what's coming down the line. Also, strange how the trillions in tax cuts for the top 20% of the elite and untouchable donor base, they still get their tax cuts immediately and without any end time either. Isn't that nice? That kind of government trough for Trump and his kind of people will run in perpetuity. Isn't that nice? But something that I have focused on a bit here and would like to give more attention to is how this same bill destroys America's much-needed long-term investments in clean energy. Trump and Republicans inserted language into the bill that will decimate the clean energy sector across the country by phasing out federal grants that were part of the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act. And this is happening after Michigan Democrats passed a large Clean Energy Jobs Act when they had the government trifecta in the state last year. Now, what will this mean for Michigan's growing clean energy sector in terms of jobs, in terms of a clean energy future, and in terms of the environment? Frank Houston is Blue Green Alliance Michigan's senior state policy manager, and he's spending some of his time here to talk about these issues on Left of Lansing here this week. Mr. Houston, thanks so much for visiting us here this week. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on, Pat. And please call me Frank.
I will do that. I will do that. I read in the American Prospect this week how the Federal Agency Regulatory Commission estimated that in the first 4 months of this year, solar and wind created nearly 97% of all electricity generating capacity in the United States. Yet, because of this new law that Trump and the Republicans celebrated on July 4th, clean energy investments will now take a direct hit, which will drastically slow down or halt many clean energy projects across the country, and especially here across Michigan. Can you share some details into how this law will affect Michigan? And if you'd like to, you know, broaden that to the entire country, please do, in terms of this growing clean energy sector and the thousands of jobs that were being created from this sector.
No, I'm happy to. And obviously, you know, our groups, not just like ours, but I mean, a pretty broad range of groups are concerned about what Congress and the president did. And I mean, here in Michigan, we know that there are 63,330 jobs that were expected to be created as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act, just in the energy and manufacturing tax credit sector of it. So when we talk about the elimination or dramatic rollbacks to the IRA that the president encouraged and Congress has now adopted, these are significant impacts that Michigan has ahead. So just a couple of main sectors I'd queue up worth considering. First, this is going to increase costs for working families. And it's at a time where, ironically, we're, you know, the president got elected, and I think we all talk about like the need to like think about how we make things more affordable for folks. And there's a reason why the Inflation Reduction Act was named that, was passed for that purpose. And this bill just frankly is going to, and the repeal of the clean energy investments comes at a time when energy costs and bills are still rising. And renewable energy sources like wind and solar that you mentioned, the support for that growing demand needs to be there if we're going to compete, we're going to diversify our economy, and we're going to keep costs down for consumers. So first problem, increases costs on working people. Secondly, it also is a lot of money rewarding billionaires, not workers, not the public. And it's obviously done so for Donald Trump and his wealthy friends. And it's frankly a disgrace. I mean, the fact that this legislation is just another example of how the president is prioritizing a narrow set of billionaires over the real challenges working people have for the vast amount of the resources tied to the bill. It should be an embarrassment to everybody who voted for it. I mentioned that, you know, this bill is going to kill jobs. I mean, there's a lot of examples of this, but the reality is in Michigan, I think the thing that's been so heartening the last few years is we have seen, I would say, a reverse, and I would say a new kind of manufacturing revitalization that's been happening. And there's examples I could give very specifically in communities across the state that has seen new manufacturing opportunities tied to auto and otherwise, that the IRA bill, CHIP program, these things have all kind of interworked with also and coupled with the work that Governor Whitmer and the state has done, has really given Michigan some great opportunities and to catch up on some of the ground that I think people arguably would say we're losing to other countries like China and EVs, for instance. And we're just throwing that away. And we know that the data shows that rolling back and sunsetting some of these credits in the IRA will mean over 25,000 jobs lost just in Michigan. That's pretty guaranteed. We also think that this jeopardizes Michigan's role in auto leadership because it takes a sledgehammer to the competitive swip we're trying to do to make us compete in these global markets that obviously value fuel economy and EVs. And it just kneecaps a sector that's really just starting to gain speed here in our state. There's been a lot of reports over the years, like I was involved in one with WRI, the World Resource Institute, that UAW and a whole bunch of other environmental groups and so on participated in, that talked about like, we really have three pathways right now we're navigating Michigan. One where we do nothing on the transition to EVs. And we know that maybe for a year or two, the jobs look as good as they've been, but then the cliff gets really steep and quick that we're going to fall off of. Another one is there's some job transition that would be challenging, but that we could still navigate through and come out ahead of within the next decade. And then a more robust path where you could see us actually adding 50,000 plus jobs here in Michigan tied to the transition to EVs. So I think like you go through sector by sector, there's these real issues. And the last thing I'll say, and sorry to go so long, is just, you know, this is reversing real climate change progress that I'm almost 50 and I've got a lot of kids. Like my sickest kids, when I look at them, I think about the legacy of what they're inheriting. The fact is the Inflation Reduction Act was one of the strongest steps that I could tell them that our generation has taken toward building a healthier, sustainable economy for their generation and ones to come. And now by gutting the IRA and derailing this kind of once in a generation progress we were making, while also locking in higher pollution, more health impacts, missing out on job opportunities for years to come, it really hits me personally to think about how I think our government is failing the young people today and how we are failing the planet when it comes to climate. So I'll stop there. Sorry, I know I said a lot.
No. That was perfect. And you're right. It is failing so many people, and especially our younger generations, and even the generations that are even here yet. Sticking just with the jobs front here for the moment. I mean, we have this growing, as you were just talking about, this growing clean energy job sector in Michigan. And I guess I look at it this way here, Frank. At a time when we're supposedly worried about our state's population and brain drain, it seems, I don't know, counterproductive for some members in Congress. Let's be honest, all of the Michigan Republicans in Congress who voted for this bill, that they supported such a bill that will slash, as you just mentioned, thousands of jobs in Michigan. So please try to make this make sense for me, because I frankly just don't understand.
I don't think it makes sense for a lot of the members themselves who voted for it. And I think you could see that in their silence leading up to the vote and coming out of it. I mean, I want to be respectful of conversations I've had in private with staff or members, but let's take a tangible Michigan example. In Lansing, you have the Grand River Assembly Plant, which was announced was last year, July, I believe, right around now, when Secretary Granholm, former Governor Granholm, came into town and announced, like, hey, we're going to be spending, I think it was about $500 million in a conversion grant to help make this plant assemble EVs. And the reason I use this example is this is A, and one of those members you're talking about, Congressmember Barrett's district, which you would say he's a freshman. He's in former now Senator Slotkin's seat, which is obviously a swing district in Michigan. These were real jobs created in a community around Ottawa that also ties into the neighboring work that's being done with the battery plant. There's like literally $881 million investment, I think, for Lansing Assembly, private investments. But then there's billions also being invested in the battery plant down the road. So you're looking at like there's all this stuff tied into, and we could go across the state with battery, like LG spending, I think it was like almost $6 billion in Holland, Michigan, for instance. There's a lot of examples of this. But that Lansing example to me was so stark because like when Secretary Granholm came and was talking about it, I had just moved to Lansing right around the time that the recession hit Lansing hard. And I remember what that was like. And I remember watching these places shutter. And there was a lot of auto workers in that area that were, frankly, were losing their homes, had lost their job, had no prospects for something to remotely keep up with their bills and be family sustaining. And to be at that announcement last summer, years later, and to see the energy and excitement, not just auto workers and corporate leaders, but the community had about the investments that were happening, and they could see how this region was revitalized and energized and preparing for the economy of the future, tied to energy, to automotive and manufacturing, and a whole set of other things, and all the other ways businesses benefit from that too, as well as working people. And to just watch those types of investments jeopardized this way, to me, is unconscionable. Now, don't get me wrong, the IRA cuts didn't roll back every single one of these, but there are several examples that are at risk. We know the Ford Motor, the project in Marshall that they were doing, Blue Oval, as it's called. They went from originally saying it was going to create 1,700 jobs, require $2.5 billion in private investments, was going to need, I mean, literally over $1 billion of public state dollars, as well as benefit from the IRA tax credits, which I don't expect everyone to know them off the top of their head, but there's 45X, 48C, 30D. These are all different tax credits that were established by IRA. To know that investments like that are slowing down, that Ford has already gone back to the state and be like, you know what, we might not create all those jobs in that timeline. We'll take less of your state dollars to just downshift our timeline to do that battery plant and to create those jobs there. There's just example after example of that, where mistakes of this administration, cutting the cord early on IRA programs that are essential for our clean energy future and the jobs of the future. It's just, I don't know how any Republican talks about it. And when I met with Congressmember Barrett's staff, some of the other ones we've met with in DC or our partners have, you would ask key members of their team or the members directly why or how they were going to handle it, and they didn't really have answers. I don't mean dismissive ones, dogmatic ones, ones that denied that this was going to be harmful. They just didn't really have answers. So I hope they actually do get out on the campaign trail over the next year and are trying to sell what they did, because this stuff is unconscionable, it's harmful, and frankly, Michigan is going to be paying the price more than most states for it.
Right. I mean, especially with all the investments that you were talking about there here in Michigan, and that Michigan was one of the leading states when it came to building a clean energy sector. Still is, I guess, as of right now. But another reason, this is so big too, is something that you talked about and I wanted to get back to, which was that you had unions. Also, we have unions on board with this whole movement because they see the future and they see the jobs that are going to be created too.
I really feel for my brothers and sister in labor. I mean, I am one. I'm a member of the United Steelworkers. And what I can say is, if I was a rank and file union member that was one of the folks tied to these clean energy jobs directly, I mean, like one of the facilities, I think I'd be having a lot of questions about what this means for my future, for my family, for my work, for the viability of my job being there in my community for years to come. Like, I grew up downriver from Detroit, and we've seen steel go through transition there. There's already been an announcement that Dearborn Works is looking now to idle, which is one of the last major steel producing facilities in Michigan, period, let alone that region. That's a UAW represented one. We know that there's a chance that U.S. Steel is going to be sold in upon. They have a facility, Great Lakes Steel does, in Ecorse that's been idle, that no one knows what's going to happen with the future of that one. We're just talking just steel. And then you go down the road and you look at like the Brownstown Battery Assembly Plant, which brought in, I want to say it was over, oh God, it was like $373 million and another additional $82 million in private investment. You know, that type of stuff that's tied to the tax credits that I was mentioning, the IRA, that are just stalling out. All the uncertainty, all the questions around what tariffs are sticking and not sticking. How can any industry do a capital outlay and understand the investments they're making aren't going to be undercut by the president in Congress a month later? It's a really challenging environment. And what that means for my labor partners, though, and my real workers, is they can't plan ahead and they don't know where to stick their neck out and say, you know what? I know I'm going to have to be reskilled or retrained, quote unquote, the transition to this different sector of this business or into a whole nother industry at time. Workers, I don't care if you're represented by electrical workers like IBEW or auto workers like UAW or steel workers like USW. All of these unions and all these workers have been utility workers in Michigan. I could go on and on. They have all been having to make tough decisions about how they look out for the best interests of each other and their membership while also taking on climate change. And for instance, I look at the utility workers in Michigan. They knew that when we were closing up all these coal-fired power plants, it's going to be a lot less union jobs. And we were fortunate in most instances where the utilities like DTE and consumers tried to take care of a lot of those utility workers that were getting close to retirement, a lot of them. But there's a lot less jobs when you close up a coal plant and then you do, for instance, wind turbines. There are less jobs. It's just a fact. But labor has been there than being creative to say, well, what are the other new jobs we can do? What is the other manufacturing side? What's to produce the component parts, the assembly? Labor has been very creative and at the table trying to figure out how to maximize those opportunities. But then when the president turns around and shifts gears and says, well, we're writing off wind turbines and wind power, we're writing off solar, it makes it nearly impossible for the industries and the unions to recalibrate that into an action plan that's in the best interest of working people. So it's a problem. And I think it leads everyone questioning what their future looks like.
I don't know if you can answer this, so I understand if you can't, you can pass on it. But I guess I'm hoping it's not this simple. But what we're seeing with this bill and how it is gutting all these clean energy investments, is it because of the power of the oil and gas lobby and that it has with this administration?
I would be lying if I didn't say it was part of it, probably, is my guess. But I also don't think it's as narrow as that. I mean, with this president, you look at how he operated his first term, you look at how he's operating this term so far. I think, just because there's a different president's name attached to it, be it Obama, Biden, or even George W. Bush, like whenever there's, I think, someone else who led a program, he seems to have sort of a natural aversion to it, even if it's working. You'll remember during his first term, he talked about passing a big, bold, beautiful infrastructure bill that never saw the light of day or any real chance of adoption. And President Biden led with what was the biggest infrastructure bill in generations. In Michigan, you look at the work that we've been able to do here, rebuilding roads, rebuilding bridges, transitioning sites, energy development, how we make sure frontline communities and workers are centered in that process, how we address equity issues. These are all things that President Biden took the lead and prioritized with Congress in making sure was part of Bill, IRA, CHIPS, all these federal programs and the people they hired. And you can just tell that that is not where this president goes. And there's an aversion to continuing the legacies of people who came before him. Not to say none of these many programs need to be tweaked or could be improved on, but that's not what he's doing, obviously. He's gunning them, destroying them. And in his wake, he's leaving not just chaos for the economy or for workers and communities, but also for the planet and or the way we operate in the world economy and with our partners in the world. And so I don't believe that just can be blamed on the oil companies, although at times I've had my issues with them. But I think it does there's a lot of other questions about. There is one high-ranking person within the Trump administration, one of his key advisors, who was involved in Project 25. And what was interesting is that person's like key deputy years ago, a Michigan person, which I won't out him here, but we had a long couple-hour conversation during the election, and he was terrified of a Trump presidency. And this is a very right-wing conservative Republican who was horrified with the prospects of Trump being elected because he felt like, candidly, the president didn't understand the industry, the oil industry that he came from.
Right.
And he thought that there was a massive bait and switch going on where, for instance, in fracking, the types of economic numbers that are being used to justify why fracking works in certain sites. They're basically taking the cream of the crop of the best targets for fracking that have the highest economic upside, the highest production upside, and then using it with a very wide swath portray this future where we can drill, baby, drill across the country. And that's going to drive down costs and that's going to sustain our energy future. So even if you agreed with fossil fuels being the primary way we approach this, which I think most people today would say we need to be shifting definitely a mix and a cleaner mix at that, this one analyst that I talked to was definitely feeling like the Trump administration, the president, just didn't have an intellectual interest in understanding these issues and the industry. And frankly, there was going to be people in that industry that would take the president for a ride and the president wouldn't know it. So a lot of speculation, but I think the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry will probably be part of the equation here. But I think it's the president just naturally doing what he does, which not a lot of rhyme or reason that I can see to it. Unless there's a billionaire attached to the other side of it. It definitely doesn't isn't what
Right.
workers or, you know, ratepayers are concerned with these days.
Well, can you talk about that real quick too? Because this will lead to massive increases in electricity rates. So not only are we losing jobs, Michiganders will now have to pay more for inefficient electricity that we're now being forced to use. Can you talk more about that?
I think there's no secret that when the coal plants in Michigan started retiring, like I grew up in Wyandotte, Michigan, the plants that were in Trenton and River Rouge that have now, shuttered, these were plants that, I mean, like the Trenton one was technically not meeting clean air standards for a while because it had been grandfathered in. It was built so long ago. There was an exemption in the Clean Air Act, and they didn't have to clean up, quote unquote, as well as other more modern coal plants. So it was a dirtier coal plant, long story short. And finally, to get detainment status, they had to make a shareholder decision of like, are we going to invest probably billions into the Trenton plant, or at least you could argue, hundreds of millions, or are we just going to shutter and go to other energy sources, be it natural gas or renewables or whatever? And it was a pretty easy decision, I think, for DTE to make to shutter that plant. So what my point here is, a lot of these places where coal closed up, it wasn't because just environmentalists wanted it. It was also because shareholders for utilities were like, these aren't economically viable compared to other energy sources long term and often even near term. So don't get me wrong, when you look at like the types of resource planning that is required of our utilities in Michigan for DTE and consumers and others, they often looked at natural gas first. They're like, oh, it'll be quicker and cheaper to do that potentially than some renewables right now, maybe. Arguably, in some locations. But they also were fine, I think, starting to put together actual comprehensive plans for also doing more wind, more solar, other mix, geothermal, and so on. What the Trump administration has done here, I think, is just fly in the face of not just what's in the interest of our planet, but the economy, and has said, you know what, let's look at coal again. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying we have to shut down every coal plant in the country overnight or every coal mine with it, but there's a reason they're closing. Economically, they are not as viable as they were 40 years ago. And even competing with renewables, they're not. I think there's a lot of confusion there. And also, when you look at the types of investments the utilities have made, even in natural gas, 25 years ago, I remember going to Illinois right after they had invested in a bunch of what were called peaker plants at the time. And those natural gas peaker plants, the idea was they would ramp up when there was more need. And frankly, when natural gas prices spiked, which they got extremely high for a couple of years, the commodity went way up in value. Then all of a sudden, the utility there, ComEd, was like, you know what? We don't want to run those plants anymore. We're going to idle them anyway, even though they had just built these new plants because the commodity value went way up in value. So I think when we start thinking about how we build a sustainable model for renewables, really just a diversified energy mix. Yes, there's things like Palisades being recommissioned as a nuclear plant in Michigan that are part of that mix. Yes, we know in parts like in the Upper Peninsula and elsewhere, there are these natural gas plants have been added to the mix. But the real viable future here is going to be how we get ahead of the curve in all the renewable mixes that have been frankly underinvested in for too long. And that's the thing that is just confounding here when we start looking back at things that even the utilities are saying, nope, time to close up those coal plants. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right, because, yeah, like you said, the marketplace is kind of deciding this, and that's where these companies want to go.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And that's why they made those decisions. I mean, and frankly, it's also hard for those local communities. I mean, you look at downriver, there's been a coalition that we've worked with of local municipalities working with county and state economic agencies, state treasury, and others. And you know, when those communities are making hard decisions around what they do with those sites when a coal site closes, or what to do with that steel site, like Great Lakes, if they in fact stay remain idle permanently. For communities to lose that huge tax base, it's one thing to lose the jobs. That's hard enough.
Yeah.
But they can lose their school system in the process too if a third of the tax base goes away when the business closes. So communities have been trying to figure out in Michigan how to do that hard work, to work together across different governmental lines with a broad range of stakeholders from the private and public sector and a whole lot of other vested interests. And to see communities do so much progress and work, and then frankly, to have to deal with this Jekyll and Hyde approach that whatever the president feels that week, and then rolling back major building block legislation and programs that can help these communities transition, extremely painful to watch, and even more painful for the people living there.
No, you're right. That is painful. One last question here for you, Frank. I saw, due to the Trump and MAGA Republican attacks on clean energy with this bill, it will result in, and I think I have this right, 7 billion extra tons of emissions into the atmosphere. And emissions are now only expected to be around 20% lower than 2005 levels by the year 2030, rather than 50 to 52% where they're supposed to be by 2030. So I'm just wondering, at a time when Detroit was just listed as the third worst city for asthma, I'm not sure how flooding more polluted air into Michigan helps us on a public health front. Oh, and while we are at it, we're at the same time cutting Medicaid. I don't understand it, but maybe that's just me.
Well, unfortunately, it's not just you, right? Like, you know, I live right outside of Detroit, and probably half my time for my kid activities we spend in Detroit. So yeah, when I'm coaching my kids' little league team on the west side of the city, for instance, and we have a combination of the Canadian fire that is happening, which is one thing that maybe we don't have complete control, but obviously we know how that's tied into climate change too.
Right.
The fact that I'm watching kids that have asthma, that some have questionable access to healthcare now moving forward, there's that. We know we have things that we're still going to build that are going to be polluting. When Stellantis expanded in Detroit, it was known by the city and elsewhere that it would become the largest polluter in the city. And that's a challenge in itself to deal with. But we're still going to build cars somewhere, and that's going to be something we're dealing with. To then also look at these other things that we could get out in front of, and the controls we could put in place, the safeguards for people's public, for their health and for the community, that we're rolling back all these things as like drivers of the conversation and the way the center, the policies we create as we move forward. Yeah, the numbers you rattle off are comparable to ones I've heard. And I think it makes it really hard also to understand, how do we proceed as a state to show leadership? Or in the Metro Detroit region, how do we, as the city and the metro counties, like how do we work together to get out in front of this when the president is attacking states and going after coalitions across the country that are working in concert to address climate change and address public health and air quality and water quality? If you just look at just from a Michigan perspective, for the first time under Governor Whitmer, we have actually developed the My Healthy Climate Plan, first climate plan we've had, and the beginnings of a real energy transition plan. And we look at those sectors for baseload energy production from plants, how we deal with manufacturing. You start going sector by sector through buildings. We are still at the front end. We're at the pubescent phase of developing the policies we need to protect our state and position us for the jobs and climate of the future. And we're just one state. And when the president operates in these ways and is constantly looking at ways to undermine good state plans, good state policies, let alone the federal funding or state funding tied to it, it makes it incredibly difficult for our state leaders and our local leaders to show leadership. Yeah, we're in big trouble. There's a lot of work to do, and there's an important election ahead. I'm not going to make this a partisan attack on Republicans and the president, but I'm really hopeful that Congressman James, as a gubernatorial candidate, for instance, he goes out there and explains what the heck is his vision for the future, because I can't see it. Someone who came out of auto manufacturing should understand how much instability is being created right now by the president from an economic perspective. And then I would also love to hear him talk about the climate and public health side, because we're all feeling it.
Now, so would I. So would I. I'd like to hear his comments and his answers to all of those questions. Frank, real quick, if people would like to learn more about Blue Green Alliance, how can they do so?
You can visit our website easily at bluegreenalliance.org. We have all the, you know, the X and other handles online. And we have some great reports, including one we put out specifically tied to IRA and jobs and the impacts there. Once again, we're a broad coalition with a lot of great organizations from the labor and the environmental movement. And many of our partners, be it the League of Conservation Voters, the Sierra Club, the United Auto Workers, they put out great reports on this as well and really try to give people the talking points and additional tools they need to understand what the heck is going on with the big bad bill that passed and unfortunately impact on for all of us here in Michigan.
All right. Frank Houston, Blue Green Alliance, Michigan Senior State Policy Manager. Thanks so much for adding your expertise here on the show here this week. And thanks for all the hard work that you guys are doing there.
No, thank you so much for having us, Pat.
You're listening to Left of Lansing. If the podcast isn't enough and you are in need of more Pat, follow him on Twitter and like him on Facebook. Also, don't forget, you can read more of his thoughts and hear an archive of past episodes on leftoflansing.com.
Special thanks there to Frank Houston from Blue Green Alliance. I'll make sure to give them a link wherever you are listening to the show, including on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to the show on YouTube and wherever you're catching this podcast. Likes and subscriptions are vital for us here on podcast land, and it also helps spread the progressive message that we're posting here throughout Michigan and the country. You know, one other part I'd like progressives to push when it comes to clean energy or a clean energy message is mass transit. While transitioning to EV cars is part of the process towards weaning ourselves off of oil, of course, it's only part of the solution. Mass transit is also another avenue we must be pushing. And it must be affordable mass transit inside our cities and also via rail throughout the entire state. So don't forget about mass transit. Time now for the Left of Lansing last call. All right, you know how much I've tried to give an honest assessment on Michigan's new Democratic Senator, Alyssa Slotkin, ever since she was running for the seat and once she officially became our senator. And if you've listened, I've been pretty down on Senator Slotkin right out of the gate here. I mean, I have criticized Slotkin on backing the Lake and Riley Act, which I believed helped open the door for the Trump regime to gain more power as they continue to kidnap undocumented people in the country and sending them now to concentration camps. I've criticized Slotkin on backing that cryptocurrency bill, that basically is just a boondoggle for the crypto industry and also for the Trump family. And I have also criticized Slotkin for being the only Democrat in the Senate to vote in favor of overturning California's car emission standards, which hurts EV jobs and the environment in her very own state. That's the one I think you can tell that really got me going. And of course, I've been critical on her so-called centrist stance, which is celebrated by corporate media, but proves to be toothless. As working Americans are getting screwed over by the Trump regime, it proves to be toothless when fascism is taking over. So I have been critical, and rightly so, I think. And also, I think that I've been fair in my criticism, which is why I have to be honest. And I'd like to get your feedback on this as well, which you can respond by emailing leftoflansing@gmail.com and also on my Facebook, on Blue Sky and Twitter pages, because I was confused this week when Senator Slotkin released this following tweet. And again, it caught me a little off guard, and I would like your reaction to it. So here's the tweet in case you missed it. Senator Slotkin wrote, "Another violent week in the Middle East. In Gaza this weekend brought the death of another 60 Palestinians who were simply seeking food and water for their families. Israel has the responsibility to allow humanitarian aid in, just as the U.S. had the responsibility to allow aid into places like Fallujah. And if President Trump's handpicked aid organization can't get food and medicine to people in Gaza in a safe way, Israel has the responsibility to find one that can. In the West Bank, Israeli settlers beat a Palestinian-American U.S. citizen to death This totals 5 Americans killed in the West Bank since October 7th of 2023, and more than a dozen Palestinians killed by lawless settler violence. It's hard to understand this lack of accountability by the Netanyahu government as anything other than tacit approval by the state, something that should be treated as abhorrent by all decent people. This violence has to end. As I saw from my own experiences in places like Iraq, democratic governments have responsibilities even when under threat. If President Trump and his team truly want a lasting ceasefire, not to mention a Nobel Peace Prize, they need to extract basic humanitarian and law and order standards now. Okay, well, I guess then I can ask, Senator, what took you so long? I mean, this kind of violence perpetrated by the right-wing Netanyahu Israeli government didn't just start happening, Senator. I mean, it's been going on for quite some time to the point that it's, you know, a genocide. Is it because Palestinian Americans are dying? I mean, that could be. But whatever it is, I guess I'm glad you're at least criticizing Israel a little bit. Better late than never. Now, will you vote, Senator, to stop funding Israel's war and genocide against the Palestinian people and stop funding Israel's desires to drag the United States into a Middle Eastern war with Iran? Or, you know, will you at least use your bully pulpit to call out Israel even more? So everyone, I'm wondering, and I think this is the question I will post on my social media, what do you make of Senator Alyssa Slotkin's recent criticism of Israel and Gaza? Promising? I'm waiting to see more. Too little, too late. And if you'd like to expound even more and give me more of your feelings, please do leftoflansing@gmail.com.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
That's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. So I am leaving for a 2-week midsummer European vacation, and I do think it is well-deserved. I just hope I'll be able to turn left. See if you movie buffs can get that one. My first time going overseas, by the way, so I am excited for us, and I'm excited that we'll be with my dad and my brother and sister-in-law for this family trip. And I am leaving a best-of show for next week, along with some new Friday shorts and Monday musings. However, there will be no show on July 31st, but I'll be back with a brand new show in August, and I might have a few things to share with you, maybe one or two of them. Special thanks to Frank Houston from Blue Green Alliance for being a fine guest here this week. Everyone, please be safe, be informed, be vigilant, and yes, remember to take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.